There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very good afternoon and welcome along to The Grill, live down here at Barasti, where for the next 3 hours we will be reflecting on a dramatic and incident-packed group stage of the FIFA World Cup. There's been drama, late goals, shocks, no shortage of VAR incidents either to dwell on, but the knockout stages have arrived and for the first time in 80 years they do not include Germany. We'll reflect on all that. We'll look ahead to this evening's last 16 games. Two absolutely mouth-watering clashes that pit Argentina against France and Uruguay against Portugal. There's lots of other sport to concentrate on as well, with qualifying for the Austrian Grand Prix scheduled for 5 p.m, Wimbledon looming large on the horizon, and the reappearances of a certain Steve Smith and David Warner on the cricket field. No Tom Urquhart today, but it's myself, Robbie Greenfield from Sports Tonight, joined by Grill regular Mark Archer and Sean O'Shea, the head of football at the Nadal Sheba Sports Complex, with you through until 6 o'clock. Lots to get through then. You can join the conversation as well by messaging us on 4001. This is The Grill, live from Barasti.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, the only place to view football this summer.
What a day. What a day it promises to be. What a day of sport. What a day of World Cup action. We've been loving it so far, it's fair to say. 2 weeks have passed since the start of the World Cup. Over 2 weeks now, and we have reached the knockout stages. It began with 32 nations. 16 remain. And for all of them, they are just 4 matches away from World Cup glory. And I will start by saying a very warm welcome and a very good afternoon to our two panellists. Let's start with the head of sport at the Nadal Sheba Sports Complex. Head of sport, head of football. I promoted you today, Sean O'Shea. Head of football, Sean O'Shea.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Robbie. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very well. You've been having a good weekend?
I've been having a great weekend, thank you.
You've got family members
in town? Yeah, doing a lot of touristy stuff, you know.
Very touristy, I'm sure. Well, we will save that for off the airwaves. But Mark Archer, a very good afternoon to you, sir.
Good to see you, Robbie. Yeah, Thursday night we departed. We were watching England take on Belgium and what was the battle of the reserve sides, and Belgium came up on top on Thursday night, but a result that probably didn't mean too much in the grander scheme of things, because it's all about the business end now. The last 16, you lose and you go home. So I'm really looking forward to this round of 16 knockout stages of the FIFA World Cup, and no quarter asked and no quarter given from now on.
This is when it traditionally gets a little bit more tighter. It gets a bit more cautious. The cavalier football that we were lucky enough to see in some of those matches in the group stages, I wonder whether that will still be here for the round of 16, Shawnee, because the pressure has been ratcheted up a notch, and the teams that going into this match, you know, we know that France, Argentina, Portugal, Uruguay, France and Argentina, incidentally, will kick off at 6 p.m. That is directly following The Grill, and then Portugal, Uruguay, they get underway at 10 p.m. local time this evening. But it's been a good World Cup thus far, hasn't it? I think we're all in agreement that we've enjoyed it. It's been dramatic. VAR, whether it's had its criticisms, it's had its detractors, of course, but FIFA are not among them, because FIFA thinks it's done a wonderful job. More on that in a moment. But for you, it's been a good World Cup.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We've spoke about it, you know, before, and it's been an exciting World Cup for different reasons. But it gets serious now, and like you say, we're at a point now where, does it become a bit more touchy? Do teams change how they play? You know, like this first game, France Argentina tonight, is going to be, hopefully it's going to be some fixture, but we'll see how it goes. But I'm not 100% sure how this one's going to go. But I think Argentina will win this game.
We've got a funny feeling. Yeah. Farah the Falcon has got a funny feeling.
Well, Argentina. She's doing all right, Farah.
She's doing all right. She's hardly perfect, but she's a bit like VAR. She's done solidly, but she's far from perfect. Yeah. It's Farah the Falcon. Mark Archer, are you sharing that opinion? France have not been brilliant this tournament thus far, but then in fairness, they haven't needed to. They've beaten Australia. They've beaten Peru. There was that drab 0-0 with Denmark, wasn't there, which was basically like a rerun of the Belgium-England game, where both sides had already qualified and it was a much changed French team. We're obviously not going to expect that kind of a side to be put out in this particular fixture, but are you with Shawnee here? Do you think Argentina can do it?
I think Argentina can do it. I think, though, France have done what they've had to do. They've won the matches, they've got the points. Players haven't played exceedingly well individually, they haven't played wonderfully well as a team, but they've played what's in front of them and got results, and that's what it's about in the group stages, is getting through to round of 16. For me, across the park, they're better man for man than Argentina. They've got some world-class players in all the key positions for France. It's just whether they can put together a team performance. And you've got to question the coaching of Didier Deschamps. Does he get them playing the best? Does he get the best out of them as a team? There's always been question marks around that. But if they click, they'd be phenomenal. But then again, you look at arguably the best player in the world ever with Lionel Messi, who may be just due a performance. He may be due to take a game by the scruff of the neck and drag Argentina across the line. And, he's playing every match for Lionel Messi now is almost his last match, possibly for Argentina, and probably at a World Cup. So he's going to give it everything. And you just know how good that man is, arguably the GOAT, the greatest of all time. He may have enough in his locker to get them past. So it's a fascinating match between, I think, France, the better team, and Argentina with the best individual in the world.
Much was made, Shawnee, of a compatriot who's been making a lot of headlines over in Russia, of Lionel Messi, Diego Maradona, for mostly the wrong reasons, it's fair to say. The less said about his antics, the better. I wonder what he's up to. I wonder whether we'll see him in the stands watching on as France take on Argentina. But when people compare Messi to Maradona, and they highlight Maradona's unbelievable one-man show in the 1986 World Cup, taking his team. Admittedly, it's not a one-man game, but he was largely the man that inspired them to victory back in Mexico in 1986. Football's changed, hasn't it? We're seeing now the likes of Sweden, the likes of Switzerland, even a team like Croatia. They've got good individuals, don't get me wrong, but organisation, tactical nuances and nous will take you a long way. And is it unfair of us to expect Lionel Messi, as good as he is, to drag this Argentinian team, as dysfunctional it is as it is, all the way through to the latter stages like they did 4 years ago?
Well, I think the football romantics in us would love to see something like that, because that's what we part of the reason that we love football and why we watch football. But I think it's harsh to put so much pressure on him. Because like you said, the gulf, or the difference between, don't like to say it, but the lesser known nations, if you like, is so small now between what it used to be a few years ago. So I think it's hard to put that kind of pressure on. We'd love to see it, but I just don't think it's going to happen in this World Cup. I don't think it is.
The interesting thing about the comparison there, the Maradona and Messi comparison, is I think we've seen the greatest moments for Lionel Messi in a Barcelona shirt, whereas we tend to remember Diego Maradona for what he did representing Argentina on the national stage, on the big stage. Controversial, yes, there were some controversial moments in Maradona's career, but some moments of absolute genius as well, where we've tended to see that with Messi in the Barcelona colours, so
true.
That's a big difference how we remember those two players.
True, but to be fair, he did it with Napoli though, didn't he, Maradona, to be fair? I mean, he took Napoli, they weren't one of the biggest clubs in Italy at the time, and he dragged them to a Serie A title as well. So I think, he's done it for both. But like you said, football's changed now and players are more athletic, and we talked about the analysis side of the game and stuff. So that, I just don't think you see, even though as great as Messi is, and the comparisons obviously between him and Maradona are there, but I just don't think you'll see a player like we used to see, like with Maradona, drag a team to win a World Cup. I mean, you could say that Ronaldo kind of did it with the European Championships with Portugal a little bit, but I don't think we'll see it. But he is due a performance, there's no doubt about that. And if he does it today and takes them through, they've got a real chance. And I think, we were talking about that before. That's the problem for me with France's Didier Deschamps. He's got great players at his disposal, but he can't seem to get them playing in a system where it plays to their strengths. And I just think that Argentina will be on a high after the other day, winning the game in the last minute. And I think that will carry them through and give them the performance that we've been looking for in a group stage and take them through to the next round.
It's an interesting one primarily as well, because I don't think there are two teams in this competition that have made the least out of the talent at their disposal as France and Argentina right now. If you think about the players that they've got, and I know it's difficult to work them all into a system that works. I know that's the jigsaw puzzle. That's the conundrum that is facing these managers. And Jorge Sampaoli is clearly ostracised from the group. Now, I don't know Lionel Messi, and reports emerging that I was reading earlier today that Lionel Messi has insisted that he is not the man picking the team and not the man giving the team talks and basically acting as a stand-in player manager. But that exchange on the touchline during the Nigeria game, where he handed some information or he gave some instructions to one of George Sampaoli's assistants, and that was relayed to Sampaoli, and then the lip readers got on the VCR monitor and actually deduced that Sampaoli was saying, "Should I bring on Kun Aguero?" I mean, that among many things that happened around Argentina, because you had Maradona's antics and histrionics in the stands, you had that going on down on the pitch at the full-time whistle as the Argentina players congratulated and celebrated with one another in the middle of the pitch. Sampaoli was straight off down the tunnel, which speaks to a huge divide between player and manager. But you look at those players at their disposal, Argentina, they haven't got the best out of Aguero, who's been the best player in the Premier League, for my money, for the last 5 or 6 years. They haven't got the best, they haven't even been playing Paulo Dybala, who's such a threat for Juventus in Serie A. What about Gonzalo Higuain, shorn of the form that we've seen so often that he's produced 4 years ago, and also for his club as well, for Juventus? So they're just not making the most of the ability, the talent they've got at their disposal. It's almost like this over-reliance on Messi, Sean, is sucking the special brilliance that all the other players have away from them.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem as well. I think going forward, attacking-wise, the players you just mentioned, they probably have the strongest front line out of all the squads in the World Cup. Or they do for me anyway, but there's so much emphasis on Messi and what kind of magic he's going to produce that it kind of, like you say, it takes away from all the other players. But the problem for Argentina, where France is stronger, is that behind the midfield they're not very strong, and we've seen them make mistakes from the goalkeeper through to the back four. So I don't know, it remains to be seen, but I just think that with Messi the pressure on him is too much. It takes away from the other players, but I think what Sampaoli should do in this game is use those attacking players that they have and go try and be on the front foot and try and basically hammer France early doors and use those strengths of the other players. I would play Aguero, I would play Dybala, I would play those players. But he doesn't seem to want to play them all at the same time for some reason, and I don't know why.
If you're Deschamps, Arch, we've seen him produce a couple of different little approaches in this World Cup thus far. He's elected to start with Olivier Giroud. He's elected to start with that front three of Dembele, of Griezmann, of Mbappe. Do you start Giroud in this game, or is he one of those guys to bring on in the 70th minute when it's 1-1?
For me, personally, watching a lot of Giroud in the Premier League, he's your super sub. He's your guy, he's your plan B. He's your, when you want to go direct and bump some long balls in there or be a threat from set pieces, he's the guy you go to. And I think you've got to play the footballers first and foremost. And no disrespect to our friend. I think you've got to play with the guys, the not Giroud. I just think he gives you that extra sort of, he can change it up. He gives you an option to revert to a different style. But what I like about the French squad is it's got such a good mix of youngsters and experienced players and sort of veterans. And you've got guys that have been there, done it. You've got guys that have won Champions League with Rafa Varane, say, in the centre of defence. You've got Hugo Lloris, who's had some great seasons at Spurs. Then you've got the likes of Pogba and your Griezmanns, guys who have played a lot of football, a lot of European club football at the highest level, and then just go put it together. And then you throw in the likes of Mbappe as a youngster and the talent they have there. You've seen they've got the perfect blend, for me, of that. It's just, again, can Deschamps maximise the talent and get them playing in an efficient style of football that suits that team? That's the question that's been levelled against them.
And Pogba, Shawnee, he's a bit like, I won't compare him to Lionel Messi, but he is the talisman of that French team, and a lot of expectation is placed on his shoulders. And it almost feels like he is feeling the weight of the burden to be the talisman, to be that almost Patrick Vieira type player in the middle of the park who just makes everything happen, the ultimate box-to-box midfielder. And there's just question marks over whether he has the consistency and the ability to actually deliver on that. We've seen flashes of it, but never time and time again.
Well, it's the same, you know, we talked about it through the season. It's been the same at Man United. I think in both teams, he's kind of in the way that the teams play, I think the position that he plays, he's restricted. So I don't think he can play his kind of natural game, which is what we were just talking about, with trying to get the best out of the players in the right positions. But like you say, with Pogba, he hasn't been consistent at United. He hasn't done great for France. And there's this whole thing around him that he's got the potential to be one of the best players on the planet, but he just hasn't delivered. And, you know, that's where Messi's different, because Messi delivers week in, week out. Okay, for Argentina, he's not been brilliant in this World Cup, but for me, Pogba, I think there's just too much hype around him. There's too much about the brand of Paul Pogba that kind of distracts him from just getting on with his game.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll be looking back on the group stages of the World Cup. More previewing, more build-up to those two huge games, including Argentina versus France at 6 p.m, Portugal versus Uruguay at 10 p.m. But when we come back, we are looking back, and we're going to start with the only place I think that we can start from the group stages, and that is, of course, Die Mannschaft. They are not in the knockout round for the first time in 80 years. We'll be asking the question why when we come back.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill in association with Barasti Superdome. Football lives at Barasti this summer.
Yeah, welcome to The Grill. It is at Barasti. The game is always on and we are live with you until 6 p.m. this afternoon when myself, Robbie Greenfield, Mark Archer, Sean O'Shea will be scuttling off to find the nearest television screen to watch what is a mouth-watering clash between France and Argentina. Two of the pre-tournament favourites meeting in the round of 16, but some cracking ties to look forward to in the 8 matches coming up over the next couple of days of World Cup action. There's a lot of live sport as well to look for and to look at. Qualifying for the Formula One Austrian Grand Prix takes place. That gets underway at 5 p.m. so stay tuned for that one. We'll be previewing Wimbledon as well, looking ahead to that. That one gets underway on Monday, the most prestigious tennis tournament for my money on the calendar. And we'll be finding and asking the question of Mark Archer whether Roger Federer can win a 9th Wimbledon crown. But for now, we're looking back on the group stages that were in the 2018 FIFA World Cup. And I'm going to put the question out there, 4001, why? Why did Germany fail at this 2018 World Cup? We've seen the curse of the world champions emerge to the point where it can be no more, or it has to be more, I might add, than just a coincidence, Sean O'Shea. Germany joining the likes of Spain in 2014, of Italy in 2010, and of France in 2002 as champions who were humbled in the group stages. But no one thought it would happen to Germany. We were all shocked. You could see it coming almost with the other nations in a way. But this one left everyone dumbfounded, didn't it?
It did. I mean, how disappointing is it they're not in the next round? I think, you know, it sounds obvious, but they didn't get off to a good start against Mexico. They were outplayed in that game, and it just got worse and worse from there on. I think, you know, it's hard to, I don't think tactically they were too bad, but I just think that there was a mix of the experienced players, and they were trying to bring new players through, and it just didn't work. But the problem for me was, and we talked about this before, was they didn't have anything on the bench that could come on and change the system or change the game. You know, we talked about Leroy Sane. Look, I know he maybe doesn't fit into the system that Joachim Löw wants to play, but he was one of the best players, if not the best, or not the best, but he was one of the best players in the Premier League, you know, last season. How could you not take him with you? You know, because there were times in games where they just needed someone to come on and do something different or create a spark, and he was that kind of player, but they just didn't have it. They were very boring, very dull, very defensive. They didn't really attack, and that game against Korea to finish off the group was just... It was embarrassing, really. For a nation like Germany, who are usually so efficient, so good, it was embarrassing to see it.
We've seen comments come into light in the last few hours from Toni Kroos, who scored that memorable free kick, Arch, in the second game against Sweden to give Germany a 2-1 win, to give them what we all thought would be the springboard to go ahead and beat South Korea and qualify for these knockout stages. But it was, like Chris McCarty said, it was papering over the cracks, and Toni Kroos has fronted up to the media. He said, in the end, we did not do enough. To be honest, if we can't score a goal in 90 minutes against South Korea, we don't deserve to go through. We got what we were deserved. We were not unlucky. It is not down to bad luck. He's called it a very black moment for German football. But that being said, fine margins exist in these games, don't they? If Mats Hummels scores in the 86th minute, Germany, you back them to hang on to a 1-0 lead and go through.
You do indeed, and Mats Hummels had a couple of headers in the last sort of 10 minutes to maybe get back into that match, but it was very un-German-like, that the lack of composure when they were really under the pump there. The Manuel Neuer, when you saw his when he basically came up the field as an outfielder, played midfield for the last 3 minutes of the match, and it was a comedy of errors. It was almost, you don't expect that from the German team. They're very well disciplined, they stick to the system, and they play, you know, the all the way to the final whistle, and they panicked a bit. I mean, Neuer, for all the experience that he has, was panicking in doing what it is. It led to the South Korean second goal, albeit the game was pretty much done and dusted. But you think, though, at 1-0, you still have a chance to equalise and get something from the match, and it was just crazy to see that from such an experienced goalkeeper. It was, maybe they were a touch overconfident, as Sean says, there's a small margin, small errors at this level, and a touch of overconfidence, a touch of players looking at other players to get them out of a hole. There was a little bit of lack of leadership. Toni Kroos was the one player that stepped up, particularly in the match against Sweden. He looked as though he wanted to dominate the game. That free kick at the end had that air of, you know, it looked as though he was going to score, and he did score. A bit of the, you know, the Cristiano Ronaldo when he stepped up against Spain. So for me, a little bit of lack of leadership, lack of composure at key moments, and then really just not getting it right. And as simple as that, really. You can't make excuses. You're not there anymore. You've gone home, and the inquest, the public inquest in the German media will be harsh.
Joachim Löw, does he stay for you, Shawnee? Does he stay to rebuild this German team?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't. He probably won't. Like, he probably won't stay in the job. I think, how long has he been in the job now? He's Klinsmann's assistant, and it obviously took over. So this is his second World Cup, I think, right?
This is his third, I think. 2010, 2014.
Oh, really? Yes.
This is his third, I believe.
So he probably won't, because it's such a devastating blow for them to go out in the group stages, and it's such an embarrassment for them. I don't think he can stay in the job. Whether it's his fault, I suppose the book always stops with the manager, but I just think that they've come to a point where they're going through that transition where their kind of golden era of players are on the way out, or, you know, they're coming to the sort of the age of retirement. They're always going to produce great players. Germany will always be a great footballing nation. There's no doubt about that. But the question is, if he does go, who comes in? Which is always the golden question with anything. But I don't know. Maybe his time's up. Maybe his time is up. And I think because of the way that they've played in this World Cup and how poor they've been, and the fact that they've crashed out bottom of the group as well, then it could be the time for him to go.
The curse of the world champions, and you can rub it off as a coincidence. You can just say, you know, yes, all these different events conspired in those different years and different times with different teams to create this what we now know as, or we're now referring to as, the curse of the world champions. Because in four of the last five World Cups, the defending champions have gone out at the group stages. Mentally, from a psychological perspective, going into a World Cup as the defending champions, is it harder, do you think, to lift yourself to be hungry enough, as those other teams are, to go ahead and do it all over again, having already kind of climbed the mountaintop?
Well, I'm not sure it's harder, because you're always going to have new players who've come into that squad who haven't won it before, so they'll be hungry. But I think there's an air of complacency and there's an air of expectation. And I think if you come in there as champions, you probably think, well, we're going to get through the groups because we won the last World Cup, so we'll get through the groups, and then we'll focus on the games that we have and try and get through, you know, the knockout round. So I think it's more of a complacency thing than anything. They've come into it, everybody says that at the beginning, everyone talks about Brazil, Argentina, but Germany, just a given that you expect them to be in and around the quarterfinals or the semi-finals, and obviously it's not happened. But yeah, for me, I think it's complacency from the nation, from the media, from the team, from the staff, that they just expect that because they're defending champions, they're going to get through.
2010, we saw the emergence of Mesut Ozil, Thomas Müller, Manuel Neuer, key players who were such an integral part of that 2014 World Cup winning side. They are now potentially playing their last, or have already played their last World Cup. Maybe not, but it's fair to say they'll all be in their 30s in 4 years' time. The new generation, the new guard, the Timo Werners of this world, the Sebastian Rudis, he played well until he had to go off against Sweden, but Timo Werner, for me, was disappointing. It just doesn't feel like they've got such a rich generation coming through.
No, that's true. I mean, Kimmich as well, another player from Bayern Munich. For me, there was... I was really looking forward to seeing Timo Werner play. I went to Leipzig last year and watched him play against Bayern Munich, and it was a great game. He scored two goals, and I thought, this guy's a smashing player. He's going to be a fantastic player. So I was really looking forward to seeing him in the World Cup. But like you say, they just didn't deliver. The young lads did not deliver at all, and I was really disappointed with all of them. But Timo Werner in particular, who I still think is a great player, there's no doubt about that. You know, you can't sort of ruin his career or say that he's going to be poor now because he's had a poor World Cup. But yeah, it's very, very strange, especially coming from Germany. It's very strange to see them play like that.
2001, Arch, things got so bad for the German football team that they decided to basically reconstruct everything, to rip everything up and perform a root and branch regeneration of their national team. Are things that bad now, or is it a case of Joachim Löw moves on, they bring in a new guy, and they, I guess, get a bit more continuity and a bit more... Get their team back, the German national team identity.
I disagree to an extent. I think they've got a conveyor belt of talent, that they've got some really strong youth structures in place. You've got a dominant club side in Bayern Munich that does well in Europe everywhere. It's been dominant in the Bundesliga, and they've got some world-class talent there. You take some of their stars like Toni Kroos at Real Madrid and the Manuel Neuers of the world, world-class players. They've got the framework there. I do think that maybe one of the factors are that they've stopped listening to the coach. Joachim Löw's been there a long time. We use the Arsene Wenger sort of scenario where your voice becomes so heard and so the same, you're not getting a kick up the bum when you need one. You're not getting a bit of inspiration because you're used to that thing. So if he's done 8 years in the job now, maybe it's time to move on. Interesting enough, he was one of the coaches rumoured just before the World Cup about maybe going on to club football, maybe was looking at that Real Madrid vacancy. And he actually re-signed a new 4-year contract with Germany. But he might want to change now and think and do the right thing. Think, I've done my time. I've had some success. It's time to go and look at club football, and maybe they need a fresh voice there, a new coaching backup to get the most out of those team and bring some youngsters through. They need to start probably regenerating with three or four younger players into that squad there. You know, 2 years away from a Euros, another 4 years away from a World Cup.
That is Germany. Let us know your thoughts. 4001, where did their downfall originate from? When we come back, we will move on to the other hot topic that has dominated the group stages at this World Cup, VAR. Is it 98.9% perfect, as FIFA say? We'll discuss that next. Yeah, welcome back to The Grill. It's myself, Robbie Greenfield, Mark Archer and Sean O'Shea with you through until 6 p.m. And we are reflecting on what was an eventful, dramatic and exciting group stages of the FIFA World Cup. We've talked about Germany and some of the reasons behind their surprising downfall. No one expected the defending champions to go out of the group stages, but they will play no part in the round of 16, much to the relief, I'm sure, of all the nations that are remaining in this tournament. But we will be looking back on some of the other talking points of this FIFA World Cup coming up. Before that, Arch, I'm conscious that there is some live sport going on.
There is indeed. Most of us taking place down under. Super Rugby returned this afternoon after a three-week break for all the international matches. One live game ongoing in Canberra. It's the Brumbies hosting the Hurricanes from New Zealand. And into the final 15 minutes, it's the Brumbies with a narrow lead, 17 points to 12 in that match, Robbie. Earlier today in Fiji, of all places, in Suva, it was a comprehensive win for the Chiefs against the Highlanders, 45 points to 22. There's also been some AFL action from Adelaide Oval. The Adelaide Crows upset the second place West Coast Eagles, 88 points to 78. And NRL results from earlier today, the Manly Seagulls had a hard-fought victory against the Penrith Panthers, 18-10. And the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldoggies, they defeated the Newcastle Knights, 36 points to 16. But Robbie, I believe also, big golf tournament happening in Europe this week, a very important one because this venue has particular relevance for later in the year.
It certainly does. The Open de France, it is taking place at Le Golf National Paris. Forgive my French accent. And it is, of course, the venue that will host the 2018 Ryder Cup. Hard to believe that has even taken. We've become so consumed in all things planet football that it's hard to believe that Wimbledon is starting on Monday and that there are actually other sporting events ongoing besides what's taking place over in Russia at the FIFA World Cup. But there is a tournament. It is the Open de France. Certainly some of the American players who are hoping to be playing, who are sure to be playing, in that Ryder Cup team, Justin Thomas, the world number two, he is among that number who have gone over to play in this Open de France. But the leader is the little-known Swede, Marcus Kinholt, adding to Swedish success after that solid performance by the national team in Russia thus far. Chris Wood is two shots behind. So Kinholt is at 6-under, Wood is at 4-under. Alex Noren, another Swede, is in a group with John Rahm, the DP World Tour Championship winner, and Bradley Dredge on 3-under. And Justin Thomas is in a group on 2-under. So it's all quite tightly packed. Clearly the course is playing in a pretty challenging due to those low scores, Mark Archer, but it's shaping up to be a good finish. And Tiger Woods is also in contention over in the Quicken Loans tournament on the PGA Tour, so it should promise to be a fairly exciting weekend of golf ahead.
Yeah, it's good to see so many Americans hopping across the Atlantic and playing on the European Tour. Of course, the likes of Justin Thomas, you said, trying to get some get some familiarity with where the Ryder Cup will be. And then, as you just said, it's the Quicken Loans National in Maryland, PGA Tour. Not a lot of the big-name players after it's been a busy schedule for them, but Tiger Woods, one player who shot 65 overnight, which is his lowest round of the year in competitive golf. So good to see him finding some form. That puts him, that's good enough after a first round of 70 to put him in a tie for 11th, 5-under par. But the top of the leaderboard there in the Quicken Loans National is three Americans, Bo Hosler, 9-under par, also joined by Ryan Armour and Brian Gay. So three players tied for first, 9-under par. They lead after two rounds of the Quicken Loans National at Maryland.
That is the golf. We will return now to talk all things football. We're looking back on the group stages of the FIFA World Cup, and it's time to turn our attention, guys, to the off-pitch talking point that simply would not stop throughout this fortnight of group action. VAR, it has been making its debut in Russia. The first decision, I believe, was in the France-Australia game on, I think, the second day of the World Cup, a decision that ultimately led to the awarding of a penalty to France that was converted by Antoine Griezmann. Since then, a lot of decisions have involved VAR, Sean O'Shea. I think you've got the stats in front of you. Now, some have been criticised. I remember particularly the Iran-Portugal game, heavily criticised in the way that VAR was used in the ultimate awarding of a penalty to Iran and an equalising goal that could have ultimately sent Portugal out had Iran taken that 92nd minute chance that fell to them from, I think, only a few yards out that was skewed wide of the post. But FIFA has come out and described the refereeing decisions at this World Cup as, and I quote, this is an official FIFA statement, very, very close to perfection following the introduction of those video assistants. Pierluigi Collina, the chairman of FIFA's refereeing committee, and his team, they've assessed all 48 group matches thus far, and of the 335 incidents that were reviewed by VAR, they said that the 14 changes of decision had lifted the percentage outcome. Shawnee, you've got the numbers there. 95 to 99.3.
Yeah, 95%, excuse me, to 99.3%. So for me, if you look at the statistics of it, I think VAR is a positive thing for football. Like we talk about it in other sports, we talk about how sports change and how sports develop. So I think that having it is a good thing. We had a great conversation with Steve Bennett, who obviously looks after the referees here in the UAE. And from speaking to him and getting more clarity on it, I think I'm a lot clearer on it now and I'm a lot more comfortable with it. I think the only issue people have with it is it's not clear to the public who are either in the stadium or watching it on the television. It's not clear how it's been used and who's making the decisions. But I think once that is spelled out to people and shown to people how it works, I think everybody will take it on board and be comfortable with it.
Who's at fault here then? Is it the media for not explaining things properly? Is it VAR and FIFA themselves for not really spelling out how it was going to be used? Because we've definitely seen some inconsistencies.
Absolutely.
Particularly
yeah.
When it comes to challenges in the penalty box and the awarding of penalties. This has been a record World Cup for penalties awarded. I think there's been something like 25 thus far. The previous record throughout an entire World Cup was 18. And we've still got 16 matches to go. So, you know, it is got to that point now where consistency becomes absolutely paramount if VAR is to be implemented correctly.
It is. I think, for me, you have to look at FIFA. FIFA have to spell it out to people and tell people exactly how this is going to work. I think it's clear for the referees. I don't think it's even clear for the players, because we've seen it time and time again in the games where there'll be an incident happens where the players will run to the referee and do the old TV screen, you know, trying to get some kind of decision from VAR. I think you have to blame is the wrong word, but FIFA have to make it clear for everybody how it's going to work in football.
What I think they're missing is a real educational piece to the public and the viewers on TV and probably the fans in the stadium. I think that, and maybe even the players and the teams, because the players seem to be a bit confused about what's a VAR incident, what's not a VAR incident. If the players are confused about what's going on the field, then you definitely know that the people watching on TV, the fans, are a bit bemused about why a decision's been reviewed, and you don't hear it. So in other sports like rugby, in NFL, even in tennis, you kind of know what the challenge is exactly about, what exactly they're looking for, whether it be an offside or a handball or a foul. You know exactly what's being reviewed and why it's being reviewed and who's referred it for review. I still don't understand it. I go back, my first experience of VAR was watching Real Madrid play the local team Jezera in the Club World Cup in December. And it was an entertaining game. Jezera 1-0 up at the time, and they scored a second goal to potentially go 2-0 up and have the biggest football upset of all time almost. And then they did score a second goal, and then it was reviewed. But no one, absolutely no one knew what was going on. And I was sitting close to a couple of friends who actually worked for FIFA. And they looked at each other going, they didn't know what was going on either at the time. And obviously people did, the officials knew. But it was still, for me, what's going on, why it's happening, what's being reviewed, what's the process, is a whole educational piece to go with it. As long as, and also just trying to refine a few sort of grey areas in it for me.
So Shawnee, in that case, should FIFA have? When we spoke to Steve Bennett, he said FIFA and the officials have been working with this technology for months now, 6 to 8 months. They're very au fait with it. They're very comfortable with it. But this is a new concept to the world at large. Most people watching this World Cup will have seen VAR for the first time. Followers of football, of course, in certain areas and certain leagues, certain cup competitions that it's been deployed in, will be aware of it and will be knowing the background to VAR. But for a lot of people tuning in, this will be the first time that they'll have ever seen something like this. Should FIFA have given this a longer run-up? Should they have saved this for the 2022 World Cup in order to for people to be comfortable with it rather than for any quirk or glitch in the way that it's actually carried out?
Well, they were obviously very comfortable to roll it out at this World Cup. They were obviously very happy with the process and how it works. So, and look, if they introduce it now or they introduce it in the next World Cup, it was always going to be new to us and new to everybody. But the problem with it is you've got football's the biggest sport on the planet and the World Cup is the most watched tournament on the planet. So I think, you know, going back to what I said before, it wasn't that they weren't ready to do it at this World Cup. I just think that it needed to be clearer for people to be able to, whether they go online or wherever, to be able to find out how exactly it's going to work, because they've been testing it at all different levels in football. The Germans are very very au fait with it because they have it in their league already. So I think people were ready for it. It's just the clarity on how it works, and that's what's caused all the controversy. And of course, we love a good story. So as soon as something happens in football where, you know, there's a little bit of controversy, and obviously VAR has been around that, then we jump on the back of it and we make a big deal out of it. But like I said before, I think it's a good thing. I just don't think it's clear to people exactly how it works. But it's obviously helping referees make correct decisions. And we're seeing, like it says here, like we talked about the stats before with the incidents that have been reviewed, referees most of the time are getting the right decisions anyway. And then when they need the assistance, they go to VAR.
And let's be honest, it's no different than other sports that have introduced video technology, whether it be cricket. It's taken the ICC and the different bodies around the world 10 years to get the decision, you know, the DRS, their system right. And then it's still not implemented in every test match series because both teams have to agree on it. So it's there, it's used, whether it be the Hawkeye system, whether it be one of the other ball tracking systems. But it doesn't have to be used, and it's distorted all sorts of bowling figures about teams that use it for LBWs, etc. So that's not still perfected 100%, but they've spent a lot of time changing it and reviewing it. NRL, Hawkeye and tennis, Super Rugby, looking at TMO, the third umpire type, the, you know, assistant things. All it does take time, and every other sport, it's not perfect first time around. So we're just going to have to bear with it, and it's going to take a couple more years, I think, to still get it to a system where everyone's 100% comfortable and understands what's going on.
Final question on VAR, boys. We've had a lot of people message in over the course of the last couple of weeks on at the Bridgewater Tavern, where we've been doing sports tonight, to say that, or to suggest that VAR should take the model from tennis, from cricket, whereby it should give a certain allocation of challenges. Steve Bennett said that they'd looked at that, but then thought, well, what if challenges have run dry? And there's a Stonewall incident in the last minute of the game that decides something. They can't risk that. But do you agree with that idea? Would that be a nice idea, Mark Archer?
Why can't you have it both ways? Why can't you have if a coach or a captain on the team feel that there's an incident that needs to be reviewed that has had an influential impact for whatever reason, they do get a number of challenges. But at the same time, the referee has the sole jurisdiction to also pull something up if he's not sure of what's happened on the field. That's the same as what happens in cricket, where each captain has three reviews and you lose a review, but the umpire can also look, challenge a no ball decision. Can he look and see whether there's a no ball or not? Can he go to a third umpire if there's a decision he's not sure about? Same with, you know, so I think there might be a mixed model that might work in there. I do get it. NFL is all based upon video replay. Coaches throwing the yellow towel into the field and stopping play and reviewing it. So they get so many challenges. And I think it might happen in basketball as well, even the referees can stop or the coach can call a timeout to do it. So maybe there's a combination of both, but I can see why the arguments would be against that as well.
Are we killing the beautiful game, Sean?
Yeah, I would be against that. Look, I think we would be changing the game too much if we were to do that. It would almost become, and it's no disrespect, it would almost become almost Americanized if it was in a way for me.
NFL style.
Yeah. It doesn't sit well with me. I think we'd be changing the game too much. Look, I accept that VAR's there, like goal line technology and everything else that we have as sports evolve and move forward, but I think this kind of challenging, you know, three challenges rule, it's not for me. I think we change the game too much.
Right then, that is VAR. Let us know your thoughts. 4001, have you got any suggestions, anything that you would like to be seen done with VAR? If you're happy with it, if you're unhappy with it, do let us know. Join the conversation on 4001. Our review of the group stages and of the World Cup thus far continues when we come back.
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, the only place to view football this summer.
We are looking back at the FIFA World Cup thus far. The group stages have concluded. The knockout rounds begin in T-minus 2 hours and 10 minutes with that France versus Argentina clash. What a mouth-watering game of football that is. Lionel Messi against Paul Pogba and co. It will be absolutely gripping stuff, I am sure of that, whatever the result. But we are looking back for now on the group stages and trying to make sense of what has been going on with this tournament thus far. We've talked about VAR, we've talked about the plight of Germany. I will ask you, Sean O'Shea, I'll put you on the spot. Standout players in this tournament thus far. Who's really impressed you? We usually see a star, don't we, emerge. A James Rodriguez. I'll use him as an example.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's been one this time around.
No, we were talking about this off air. I don't think there has been. Maybe at the end of the World Cup. Now we're getting to the knockout stage and it gets serious. Maybe we will see somebody step up and perform. But at the minute, nobody's really... There's no emerging player that's kind of stood out where you think, oh, this guy, not really
Lozano?
Heard. I think we got too excited about Lozano. I think Mexico played very well in the first game. They beat Germany. It was a great move for the goal. But I haven't really seen too much of him in the second and third game to think that he's actually, you know, a potential superstar. I haven't seen enough of him. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think, like I said, by the end of the World Cup, we may see somebody now. We may see someone carry their team through to a final and win the World Cup. But for me, I said it the other day, Luka Modric for me has been the best player in the World Cup so far. Him and Coutinho. They're the only players who we expect, you know, good performances from. And they're for me the two players who've actually delivered as well.
Who's been the team of the tournament so far, Arch?
Oh, that's a tough question. We've got three teams that are undefeated after group stages. Belgium, of course, still a bit hard to get a handle on them. Obviously, two easy wins. And then they obviously got past England with almost a B-side, their reserves on the week. So it's hard to see where Belgium are at yet. And they did have some... They're always that underdog that team fans do well. So they've done well. For me, the best performances have been by Croatia across the three matches. And they made changes for their last match. And the guys that came into the team stepped up and played well. For me... Three consistent performances of a very high standard with the likes of Modric and Rakitic and Mandzukic when he's been on have been world class. They've been the team that's been consistently looked good. And then the other undefeated team's Uruguay. So it's tough to go past the three teams that have won all three matches so far. But for me, across those three matches, Croatia have been the most impressive. Whether they can take that form in really deep into the tournament, I have my question marks, but they're a heck of a tough team to play against.
We wondered before the start of this tournament, Shawnee, whether a small nation, and I'll use that in inverted commas, because you look at Belgium's team, Hazard, De Bruyne, Lukaku, Dries Mertens, it's far from, even from an attacking point of view, and then you look at the defence as well, Alderweireld, Courtois, etc. They've got fantastic players throughout, but they would come under the bracket of a small nation. If you look at the kind of the heavyweights of the World Cup, historically... We did wonder whether someone might break through, a team, a smaller nation might break through. Have you seen enough from the group stages to suggest that that will happen? Or do you feel that in the knockout rounds, experience will count, things might revert to type, and we might see the likes of Spain and Brazil start to negotiate their way through?
I actually think Croatia have got a chance of winning this World Cup. I really do. I think they've been very solid in the games they've played. They've got a good team structure. They know how they want to play. They're very aggressive. They work hard, but they've played some very nice football. And like Mark was saying, they've put in three very good performances to get through the group. For me, we wouldn't class Uruguay as a smaller nation, would we?
They're on the cusp, I'd say. I mean, they did win back in the 30s.
Yeah, which was a long time ago. But for me, they've got a chance. They've been very good. Like, haven't conceded a goal yet. Three good performances. Great at the back. They've got two very, very good strikers in Suarez and Cavani. So for me, if we're going to put them in that bracket, I would say Croatia or Uruguay have got a chance of winning it, I think. I really do.
You wouldn't give Belgium a chance?
Yeah, well, look, they're in the knockout stages, definitely. But I don't think they've played unbelievably well. Look, they beat Tunisia and Panama and England. Now... The England game, people have got their opinions on it because they were both very changed teams. But Panama, for me, were the worst team I've seen in a World Cup for a long, long time. They were terrible. And Tunisia weren't brilliant either. You know, England struggled to get through them, but Belgium turned them over pretty easily. So I don't think Belgium have been challenged enough. I don't think we've seen them being challenged to say, yeah, they can go win a World Cup, whereas Croatia turned Argentina over with ease like the other night. So for me, look, they can go far. They'll probably get through Japan, get to the quarterfinals, but that might be the end of the road for them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that big match on Thursday, the England-Belgium clash that we all sort of looked forward to when the draw came out, which didn't really become a bit of a who wants to finish second, who wants to finish first, should we score, should you score? You know, those teams looked like they were heading for a 0-0 for much of the game. But, you know, you expect Belgium now to navigate their way past Japan. You think that Japan were in some ways quite lucky to nip through the card situation that eliminated Senegal. You think Belgium will get past that. You just think, though, on their day, they have enough potentially to get past Brazil or Mexico as well. On their day, they have enough talent of guys that can do it. I have no doubt they can advance past that and take Japan out, but also take one of those big South or Central American scalps as well at the quarterfinal stage, Brazil or Mexico.
There you have it. There is the verdict for Mark Archer. France, are they contenders, Shawnee? Are they? We're going to find out in a couple of hours' time when they play Argentina, but they were talked about as among the favourites, and it's been a I would describe it as a tepid performance in the group stages for France. What is the group stages all about? You obviously want to get through. You want to face a test, don't you? You want to ready yourself for the pressure-packed atmosphere of the knockout rounds and the fact you're going to be coming up against bigger opposition. But then again, you don't want to be fighting for your life in every game either.
Well, you don't, no, but you want to be tested because you want to have that momentum and confidence going through to the knockout stages, which, for me, France, I don't think have that. Sweden, for example, we were just talking about them off air, have been superb. And the result for them against Mexico will give them that confidence and momentum going into the knockout stages. For me, France, you know, the same as Belgium. Not the same as Belgium. But France, on paper, have one of the best squads in the World Cup, without a shadow of a doubt. But they're just not performing. They're not playing to the players' strengths. They're not playing a system that I think works for them. And you know me with my predictions. I'm usually very, very wrong. But I don't see them going past Argentina today. I really don't.
That is a big shout. I mean,
I'm probably wrong because I usually am with my predictions, but
the smart money is on France, yeah. But the hunch could definitely be on Argentina.
I think going through those group stages and getting those performances and that late winner from Rojo against Nigeria would just lifted the whole squad. Now, you don't really know what's happening off the pitch with the manager and stuff like that, but I think the players will be confident and I think they'll go into that game believing that they can win that.
What of the teams that have performed beyond what was expected of them, that have excelled to the point where they've taken people by surprise? I'll throw a Russia at you. No one thought much of the chances of the host nation, but they came out in that first game and defeated Saudi Arabia, admittedly one of the weaker sides in the tournament, but 5-0, and they got through in a straightforward enough group, as it turned out.
Yeah.
Switzerland, Sweden have all done well. What sides have most impressed you?
To be honest, I'd say Switzerland. Switzerland have been very, very good for me. Look, they're not a team of superstars. They don't play a great brand of football, but they've come into the tournament with a plan, with a system. They've gone into each game with a very obvious game plan, and they've got the results and got through. And for me, you know, your players like Shaqiri and Granit Xhaka, who haven't performed very, very well at club level, have done so well in this World Cup for them. And for me, you know, we talked about Sweden. I think for me, I expected Sweden to go through, but Switzerland definitely have been the most impressive for me. Peru were very good. I felt sorry for Peru because I thought they put in 3 good performances but didn't really get anything out of the World Cup in the end. But in terms of qualification, Switzerland for me have been the most impressive.
Yeah, of the unlucky teams, you could definitely throw Senegal in there as well.
Yeah, you could, absolutely.
To go out on fair
harsh
play.
Yeah, that's very
that
harsh.
That was very harsh. And Peru, yeah, absolutely, I'd go along with that. Arch, what about the Golden Boot? Harry Kane currently leading the standings on 5 goals. You've got Romelu Lukaku on 4, Cristiano Ronaldo on 4. Is it a 3-horse race for that?
Well, it's all going to depend on usually the Golden Boot goes to one of the players and the teams that makes the final, unless you get a hatful early like we've seen with Kane and Lukaku. The interesting thing about those two players is they've only played 2 matches each. They both missed that third match, which you would have thought if you're Harry Kane or you're Romelu Lukaku, there's probably a goal in that
they
match
weren't happy
them.
About it.
No.
Well, but you've got to look at the greater good, I guess. And for me, though, again, I think the Golden Boot winner usually comes from one of the two teams in the final, just because you played more matches. But those two guys, and I'll take this the right way, they're probably flat-track bullied 2 of the lesser teams. You know, and Harry Kane, look, he had 2 penalties and a dodgy sort of deflection for his hat-trick in the Panama match, wasn't it? And so you'd see it there. You just wonder if one of the out-and-out goal scorers can now start getting some consistency, whether it be a Griezmann can get a couple of goals or... You know, whether Ronaldo, again, if Portugal advance in the tournament, you know Ronaldo's probably scored some goals. It's just the way it's going to happen there. So if Portugal go into, say, semi-final stage, you expect Ronaldo to have 5 or 6 goals. It's just the nature of that match. So tough to call at this stage. Let's give it another round to see who gets through this round of 16. At quarter-final stage, I think you can see who's then eliminated from that race.
Has Ronaldo been the player of the tournament so far?
Modric,
for you.
Yeah, Modric to me, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Arch, you'd agree with that?
I'd agree with Modric, yeah. I mean... He's phenomenal. When you watch the game, but just watch Modric, he does so much. He works so hard from box to box, and he does it all. You know, he scores goals. He provides so many passes. He's the guy that always goes to where the ball is and wants the pass, whether he be in defence, you know, back almost in your back four, just in front of the back four, or whether it be almost in, you know, attacking mode, just behind the front striker with Mandzukic. He runs so many kilometres and takes so many touches for me, and he influences matches. he does things that influence the matches.
And Croatia will be fancying that round of 16 tie against Denmark, I feel, like they're definitely the favourites to go through in that one. We'll build up to more of that World Cup action in the next hour of this programme. When we come back, we'll return our focus to the world outside of the FIFA World Cup. We're going to be talking Wimbledon. That one gets underway on Monday. It's a chance, perhaps, for Roger Federer to win a 9th Wimbledon title and a 21st Grand Slam. Can he possibly do it? We'll get the thoughts of the guys and we'll chat tennis when we come back.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.